Welcome to The Upward Spiral, a music business podcast presented by Hypebot.com. Today on the podcast, we are talking with Paul Cantor, a writer and producer who recently published a piece on Medium about why television is killing the movie business and what that means. We are going to talk to Paul about his essay and what the film and TV industry can learn from the music business. I am Kyle Berlin, a user experience researcher and music technology writer, now author of Promised Land, Youth Culture, Disruptive Startups, and the Social Music Revolution.
And I'm Courtney Harding. I run media strategy for Mizuka, a music startup.
As I said at the top of the show, we are joined by Paul Cantor. Say hello, Paul.
How's it going, everybody? Good to be here. I appreciate you having me on.
Cool. So, Paul, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're working on before we jump into the questions.
Cool. Well, I'm primarily, concentrated in three different things. I'm a writer, an editor, and also a music producer. I've been doing all three of those things for about 10 years with slight diversions, as anybody who works in creative industries can, get into other stuff. So I've also worked in concerts. I've managed artists. So I've done a variety of, different offshoot things. I started in music as a studio owner about 10 years ago. I've had two studios, which I don't have anymore, primarily because of changes in the music industry. So right now, I mostly, like I said, write, edit, and produce. I write a lot for Vice, Billboard, Rolling Stone, Vibe, XXL, mostly music magazines. And then in addition to that, I've produced, so I'm, I'm always pitching stuff to television networks and artists, things of that nature. So yeah, that's a little bit of background on myself.
Awesome. Very cool. So it sounds like we're going to have a pretty fantastic discussion today, given your background. This would be not the first time that it's been three people who all have Billboard connections, three music writers on a podcast. My God, people, please don't turn us off. I can hear people being like, delete. Anyway, so, the reason I initially approached you about doing this podcast was I read a piece that you had up on Medium, which I found really interesting about, why TV is doing well and film is struggling in sort of the social age, and how the way that we consume TV is really forward-thinking, and the way that we consume film, for the most part, still feels very antiquated. So just to sort of spin it out a little bit more, I feel like, during my teens and 20s, when I would go to parties or meet people or just talk to people, a lot of it was about music, and people would really talk about, like, here's what I'm listening to, here's the concerts I'm going to. Like, music was a very big part of their identity and their fabric. Now that I'm in my 30s, and it could just be because I'm getting older, I feel like when I talk to my peers, it's really about TV. It's, what are you watching? Are you watching Game of Thrones? Are you watching Mad Men? Are you watching Orphan Black? What are you binge watching? What's the hot up and coming series that no one's talking about, but everyone's going to binge watch in a year? Like, TV has really replaced music as sort of the center of this conversation. And I'm just wondering if, like, TV has now become the medium of the moment, replacing film and music and other outlets.
I think there's a lot in that. One, I think TV lends itself to older people. I'm sure, the people that you're talking to are not talking about the latest teen drama, that's on the CW network or something like that, which I'm sure there is one that a lot of teens are watching. A lot of television in the past 10 years has really matured, and now you kind of have these sort of smart intellectual shows like Mad Men that appeal to, people who are in their late 20s, early 30s, and beyond. It's not like, TV has just matured so much, and these shows are kind of like really for a smart viewer. And so it that lends itself to, you know, the sort of highly educated, 30-something who maybe is home in the evening or has DVR and can watch these sort of things. I don't know. Music, to me, I definitely think there's still a large conversation happening around it, but it's much more niche and much more fragmented, to the point where it's a little bit hard to sort of track the conversation. It's a little harder to identify it. Sometimes, for example, there can be a big band or a big artist that is really popular, but because we're trying to use a lot of analytic tools and things like Twitter and Facebook to sort of find these conversations, you know, sometimes things are just not happening, particularly online, because people aren't as apt to talk about them. You know, a person can enjoy something without having a conversation about it. They might be just enjoying it with their friends. We see that a lot with music nowadays, where something is happening completely out of the conversation. It's almost like the conversation is manufactured in a way about something that nobody is talking about. And then there's some random thing that you're not hearing anything about, and you go on YouTube or something, and you see this video that you haven't heard anything about, that none of your friends are talking about, has like 25 million, you know, views or something, and you're like, where is this all coming from? And it's like, it's just happening in its own little world, you know. And I've noticed that more and more, you know, over the past couple of years.
Well, I feel like you raise a couple interesting points, and one is, you know, that TV has gotten smarter, because, again, I grew up in the 90s, and back then it was kind of a badge of honor to be like, I don't have a TV. TV rots your brain. TV is stupid. And there were a couple shows that were pretty good back in the day, but generally people were not as up on TV. And now I feel like you would be looked at as a weirdo if you didn't have at least one show that you were watching, of sort of the smart set of shows, the HBO shows, the Showtime shows, the AMC and BBC America and all those. And two, I feel like there's a lot to unpack in terms of the fragmentation of culture and the death of this sort of like mass cultural moment. Like, you know, when Roots aired, and I don't think I was alive then or I would have been very young, but like Roots, I feel like 25 million people watched Roots. Like, 25 million people were watching Friends. And then you look at Game of Thrones, which is a show that I hear a lot about. And I don't know, a couple million people watch Game of Thrones, maybe? You know, Mad Men, it's like 2 million people are watching Mad Men. Like, the numbers aren't really there, although the conversation is big.
I think I saw, I don't have the exact number off the top of my head, but it was something like 2 million people or 3 million people watched the finale of Breaking Bad. Meanwhile, like NCIS on like an average night, you know, does like 9 million, you know. Yeah. So, and just think about how much conversation and how much ink and how many people typed articles, you know, about Breaking Bad. It can often seem like everybody's watching the same thing and that everybody is sort of, you know, tuned in, but they're really not. That's social media can really amp up a conversation that really is not happening, but make it seem like it is. Also, companies like Twitter, they're like really deeply in bed with the television industry in a lot of ways. They get huge ad buys from the television networks to basically promote their content when it's on. So some of that conversation is being manufactured. It's almost you're being influenced to kind of talk about these things. Trending topics change to whatever is on, And then, you know, somebody kind of sees it, and, you know, it starts at a very micro, you know, level, and then it sort of explodes and becomes this larger conversation. But there's still only 2 million people watching it. There's like 320 million people in the United States. So it's a really small audience. And out of those 320 million people, you'd be willing to bet a lot of them have televisions. So it's not like everybody's watching the same thing. So also I think, like, again, to your point about Roots, which was like mature, that is very mature viewing. You know, you would see something like that now, it'd probably be like 1,000 Slate articles and Salon think pieces about that. You know, you know, if somebody was doing that today, man, it would be really difficult to get 25 million people to tune in, even no matter how smart it was. You know, it's just much harder.
Yeah, and I feel like some of it too might be that it's not accurately reflected, because I don't watch a lot of TV in real time. In fact, I almost never, unless it's sports, I don't watch TV in real time. I either DVR stuff, or I watch it on HBO Go, or I watch it on Amazon Prime, or I'll confess, sometimes I watch it on those sketchy sites that I find when I Google watch such and such for free. And I feel like, you know, maybe one of the things we're doing is we're not looking at the right numbers for this, because, you know, 2 million people are watching Mad Men while it's on. But that number might double if you look at, well, who's watching it on DVR, who's watching it on iTunes, who's watching it on your sketchy watchtvfree.com site.
Oh, no, absolutely. And that's kind of the point I was trying to make. I think when I wrote, you know, that piece was really written just based on an observation. I didn't really have any, you know, it's not like I was sitting around looking at data, although in, you know, the aftermath of it, I did have a few people who I guess work, you know, at firms and things of that nature who have the movie industry as clients, did send me data to show me, you know, certain aspects of movie attendance that were up, down, you know, ticket sales, you know, year over year. So I did get a chance to look at some of that stuff. But when I wrote it, it was really just an observation, like you were talking about how you might speak to your friends and people are like, oh, you know, did you watch such and such? You know, you have to watch it. It's so good. You know, like everybody's had that conversation, you know, oh, you have to see Breaking Bad, or, you know, when that finale was happening. I mean, that conversation was sort of inescapable. But the point was that it's so much easier to get into television, because even if I'm not right there when the show is happening, I can actually go back and I can download the AMC app, or I can go on HBO Go. Any show I pretty much want to watch is sort of accessible to me, and I can get into it a little bit late. For example, like Scandal is a big show. So if you wanted to watch Scandal, you could watch like the first, second season all in like a day or two and then kind of catch up. I think it's in the third season now. So it's like, what can the movie industry do to sort of get itself like able to compete with that? Because that's a really big thing. I mean, that, you know, that just being able to just sort of snack on this endless stream of television content is like amazing, you know.
But you can snack on an endless stream of film content if you have Netflix, or honestly, if you have popcorn time, which I'm not saying I do.
I have it.
And like the thing is with movies, you're looking at, I mean, unless you're watching like Das Boot, you're looking at a 3-hour time commitment, absolute maximum. You're looking more at probably like an hour and a half, 2-hour time commitment for a movie, whereas for a TV show, I mean, depending on how many seasons in and how long it is, I mean, you're looking at weeks of time to catch up on this content. So I don't know that it's necessarily that. And again, just to bring in music here, if you're looking at music, that's content that's even easier to consume because, you again, an album is, what, 45 minutes to an hour, and you can consume that while you're doing something else.
One of what you're saying is actually the reason why I don't watch a ton of television. I just recently started to, you know, I got into like Penny Dreadful and, you know, because it was just so hard to ignore all the advertising for it. But I prefer movies. I mean, I want to consume a movie, hour and a half, I'm done. You know, I'm not really looking like watching television is like being in a relationship. You know, it's like you have to be here at this time. You know, if you don't do it, you got to go watch it again, check back what happened on the last episode. You know, it's like a commitment, and there's like 1,000 shows. You know, there's so much crossover. It's difficult. I don't have the patience for it. I much rather have watched like Boy Meets World, like 30 minutes. You know, I liked sitcoms. You know, it was like kind of this happened, next episode is completely different. You know, it's a situation and it's over. So movies, in a lot of ways, you know, they have that going for them. Music, I think a lot of music people are way out ahead of everyone, primarily because the music industry sort of fell apart before all these other businesses. Musicians kind of had to, in the music industry at large, sort of had to figure itself out before all the other businesses. I mean, a lot of what the media industry is going through now, the music industry kind of went through 10 years ago of just sort of how do we sell things to people? What's our business model going to be? Now you can have that, like you said, that experience of I can listen to an album for an hour. It's, you know, it's not that big of a commitment. But I think even an hour is kind of a large commitment on the part of musicians. Sometimes I will go on Spotify or something, and it's hard to tell like what to listen to. There's just so much music. It becomes a little hard to sift through. So it almost has the same problem television has, which is that you have unlimited access to all this stuff, and everything is a little bit of a commitment. And it's like, what do I listen to? And music's a little bit different because each song is almost like an episode, you know. You might not necessarily want to listen to an hour of somebody's material. You might only want to listen to 3.5 minutes, you know. That's a story in and of itself right there. You don't always have to hear a whole album to get that. So, like music, definitely, you see most musicians nowadays are releasing product pretty much continuously. You don't have that that big blockbuster LP so much anymore. And if you do, you get re-releases and things of that nature. You know, here's the album again with 6 new tracks, you know? So,
yeah. I kind of wanted to chat a little bit about music streaming and video streaming, and I'm glad that you brought that up. You know, if you look at web traffic, like, I feel like Netflix is this huge chunk of web traffic, and people who aren't digitally savvy people use Netflix. Like, my parents have Netflix, my, you know, aunt and uncle have Netflix. Like, everyone I know has Netflix or Hulu or something like that, and they're very comfortable with it. But if you look at the numbers for Spotify, and I'll throw RDO and Beats and Rhapsody and all those other services in there, people have not converted to streaming music nearly to the level they've converted to streaming video and TV and film. So I'm just kind of curious as to why you think that is. Like, why have people converted so much to streaming video but not to music, or not as much to music?
I think one reason why is that you really just have the number two website, I think, in the world is still YouTube behind Google, right? So pretty much you can listen to anything on there. So why would you convert to something else? I mean, you can make a playlist on YouTube. You can do a lot of things with YouTube. YouTube is rather powerful as a streaming platform. I mean, I've probably you know, as far back as maybe 2007 or 2008, would have conversations with people and they would say, well, what's the last thing you bought or what have you been listening to? And I would just say, I don't know, whatever I look at on YouTube, you know, like I pretty much would make playlists in there. And I kind of was using it as a streaming platform before we really had Spotify here. Spotify in particular has not attracted a large audience, despite all the hype. I mean, I think they're only at something like, what is it, like 1 or 2 million paying subscribers or something
it's,
like
it's
that?
It's higher. It's higher than that, but it's, I feel like the last I heard was six million.
I know the user base is higher, but the actual paying number is pretty small.
I feel like the paying number, the last I heard was six.
I mean, even if it's
but
six.
Still, that's six out of, again, as you said, 320 million people in the U.S.
I mean, six is not, to me, a large number, but I do believe, like, Pandora is super popular.
Yes.
I mean, Pandora is like the Netflix of digital music. Everybody uses Pandora who's just like the average, you know, I don't, you know, I'm not like a music nerd and not a tech nerd. Everybody has Pandora. You know, sometimes you go into bars or even restaurants and they'll have a little soundtrack going and you're like, man, this sounds incredible. And then you'll ask a waiter, what is this? And they'll say, oh, this is like Biggie Pandora or Tupac Pandora or something like that, you know? And it's just that in and of itself is interesting because, you know, a lot of bars and restaurants have to pay licensing fees for playing music and they're sort of getting around that by using Pandora. So there's a, you know, Pandora is an interesting, they have a lot of interesting stuff going on. And I think they're a lot more popular than everyone thinks. But as far as buying music and the subscription services sort of catching on, I do think there's an audience that still pays for CDs and still buys CDs. It's not huge. And then there's a lot of people who are just straight up stealing stuff. You know, piracy is still a very large thing. A few months ago, I did an interview, a rather long one, with Kim.com, you know, from, you know, CEO of Mega Upload. And he spoke to me, you know, from his home in New Zealand, where he's like on house arrest, basically, and the Justice Department's trying to extradite him. And I mean, the reality of it is piracy is a very serious thing. It's massive. It's just not a conversation that is happening a lot in the media right now because the streaming services are so such a hot topic. But piracy is still major. And if you go on any torrent site or even on something like Kim.com's Mega, which is his new Mega Upload, and you can find anything, and it's all encrypted now, and I mean, it's pretty amazing. So most of these things are just like a click or two away, and they're pretty easy to get, and I don't necessarily think that the ISPs and Google in particular are doing enough to enforce that. I mean, if they were to just extinguish that from the internet, you would have a lot more people saying, gotta subscribe to something. I partly started using Amazon Prime on my television through like a PlayStation. Like, I don't really use Netflix too much anymore. But one of the reasons why I started paying for everything on Amazon Prime was because I was getting all my movies and stuff off of BitTorrent. And BitTorrent, the movie industry started baking like a thing into the file that just would not allow it to play. And it became very difficult to do the whole conversion process. It was just like, man, this is so annoying. I would just rather pay for this. basically, to strip out this protection was so hard. So I was like, I'll just pay. Now, if the music industry figured that out for all its pirated, you know, content, I mean, people would just say, I got to sign up for this thing. And it would be a done deal. Still there?
So we've been talking about, you know, the television industry as well as streaming services. I'd love to hear your thoughts, Paul, on what the music industry can learn from the television industry.
I think what music can learn from television is that episodic programming and episodic content releases are basically the way that they should approach their projects. Nowadays, when new artists talk to me about releasing a project, I sort of advise them that they should be coming up with a comprehensive 360-degree content program, not a music program of like, I'm going to release an album and this is what I'm going to do around it. I'd say you should plan out a year of content, and that year of content should be completely immersive and contain a whole variety of different things. That should be a website, that should be a blog, that should be a video platform, that should be a video series, that should be your music, you know, it should be behind the scenes footage, Instagrams, Vine, anything, that any piece of content that you can think of. You have to weave this into one comprehensive plan and then come up with a rollout for it. There is no barrier between, you know, the digital and the human. We are sort of in the age of the wearable tech and the Internet of Things. So a person is almost, a potential fan, for example, is basically with you every hour of the day. So you can keep giving them stuff, giving them stuff, giving them stuff, and they're just going to keep tuning in. You're almost like a walking television show. So you have to create the programming for this walking television show. Things like Twitter, which, you know, let's face it, people are talking now about Twitter sort of being over, and they might be right. But, you know, for now, Twitter is a, you know, it's a broadcast system. You're broadcasting messages. You're putting messaging out there. And you have all this capability to do it. And some artists, you know, are using it and doing it that way, where they're putting out messaging and they're kind of keeping fans informed. But there's also another way to use it where it's sort of conversational and people are, you know, really seem like they're attached to you. The music industry in particular is still very much a recorded music business. I think that the album is looked at as a promotional thing again, which is good. And they think they can, you know, use that to sort of springboard a tour, things of that nature. The album is definitely looked at, you know, as part of like a content thing, but it's not, you know, it's still very much like my album is coming out June 20th. Check it out, you know, and I just don't feel like that particular sort of thing, you know, works. I think, you know, releasing a song, then a week later releasing another song, and then maybe, you know, after X amount of songs drop, you say, okay, here's a collection of the songs, and you create some sort of narrative around it and make it a story. And people like that sort of thing. I mean, that's one of the reasons why fan fiction and stuff like that is so popular. Imagine if the music industry capitalized on One Direction fan fiction in like a real way. They would make so much more money, you know, because there's like 1,000 stories every day about Harry Styles, you know, that they don't have anything to do with. You know, what if they curated that and put that someplace and sold advertising against it? You know, there's money there, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
So you said a lot of things there. I mean, you're basically suggesting that artists become their own creative agencies and that they deploy year-long transmedia storytelling projects, and that through that they're going to hook in these potential listeners, convert them to passionate followers, and that those people are going to follow them for that entire journey and potentially see them live in concert. I mean, do you think that is the reality? That I definitely agree that an artist has to do that, but does the fan truly want it, and how many are willing to go down that rabbit hole with an artist?
I'm not sure. I think that when you look at certain artists who do have very engaged fan bases, you know, there's people who are very off the radar, who are not, you know, not in the conversation or the popular music conversation at all. But then you go on their Instagram or something to that effect, and I mean, they'll put up one picture and it has, you know, 98,000 likes or something like that. Now, obviously, converting 98,000 likes into a record sale is not always so easy. I mean, I think there's been a lot of experiments with that. I think Sebastian Bach had a Facebook post last week, and it was something along the lines of, you know, I have how many million Facebook friends, and like, you know, 1,000 people bought my record. So I think the analytics can often be a little bit of trickery. They can make you seem like you're more relevant than you really are to people, which is one of the reasons why. I don't know. You know, you kind of have to say these transmedia experiences have to be part of a comprehensive brand building exercise, and not so much a I'm going to sell a person, you know, a record exercise. In hip hop, for example, you have guys like Riff Raff, who is frankly not a great musician, but he's just such a character. I don't know if you guys are familiar with him, but
oh, yeah.
You know, he's such a character, and he has so much. He was so popular, you know, that, you know, he inspired the Spring Breakers, James Franco's character in that film. Now, I mean, he didn't see any money out of it, which I believe he's suing over. But I mean, Riff Raff can do a lot of things with that audience. If he wants, he could potentially do something else, like maybe release a book. You know, he might release an album. Maybe he'll make some films. A lot of money now is not necessarily coming from a record industry. A record industry will tell you they don't have any money for anything. If you go to a record label, it's like a ghost town. But where there is money, it might be from Reebok, or I just saw something earlier today with Dr. Pepper sponsoring, you know, a whole music series. Those people have money, and they want to do business with people who look like they're invested in the culture, have an audience, and people care about what they have to say. And you can honestly, all these tools are online now where you can sort of show that stuff. People are just looking at numbers, really, first and foremost. I mean, I think a lot of times when you may be asked to check out a new artist, you might go to their Facebook page and say, and look at how many people like them first, which is kind of sad. But I mean, I sometimes do that as well. I say, oh man, how many Facebook likes does this guy have, or this female have? How many Twitter followers? That stuff really influences you in a lot of ways. I don't know how many artists, though, want to do all that stuff. I don't think many of them do. I think it's actually asking a lot of artists, and this is not a good situation. It's terrible, actually. If I make music, I don't want to be tweeting all day. I just want to stay in the studio and make my records and be done with it, you know? So it's not a good situation. I mean, it's purely because of the market.
Absolutely. I mean, it's definitely a challenge when you go to, you know, like recently I co-hosted a panel at a music business school, and, you know, numerous students were wondering, okay, I want to release music. What should I do? And they were just starting from the rock bottom. They weren't trying to build a medium-sized audience into a bigger one. It's like, oh yeah, get the Facebook likes, get the Twitter followers, constantly Instagram, make your music. And you could tell that they're kind of a little bit like bewildered by that advice, because it's like, one, who has the time? Two, they truly are starting from nothing. They're, you know, posting Instagram photos to no one is really hard, let alone trying to make original music.
Yeah, no, it's that advice that I'm saying is the, like, get your Facebook likes up, do your Twitter. I mean, it's frankly, it's not the most amazing advice, and it's not the most original advice either. I think people have, you know, taken a lot of non-creative people who don't make music, who are giving musicians that advice. When you're making music, the last thing you want to be doing is thinking about that stuff. You know, you don't want to be Instagramming. You know, it's just not good for the creative process. I've been in the studio with artists many times where they're, you know, basically in the middle of writing a song and they're, you know, on Instagram and stuff like that. It's kind of mind-boggling. You know, I don't know how people can sort of maintain those multiple strands of consciousness. It's almost like compartmentalizing the creative process. And that, I think, reflects a lot in the music, whereas instead of having a one-way conversation where the artist is speaking truly from what they have to say within them, they're actually saying stuff that's sort of a reflection of what people are saying back at them, which is maybe good, but also arguably a little bit of an artistic conundrum. You know, think about some of the great records that have touched you in your life. I don't know. There's something about the artist sort of toiling away on his own that's very romantic and beautiful, and to feel like maybe that wasn't actually happening and they were just sort of sitting there vining things, it just kind of ruins it for me, you know?
And just to kind of bring it back to the TV stuff that we were talking about earlier, you know, a lot of the Breaking Bad tweets, we'll stay on that show, like, you know, Bryan Cranston's not posting those. I mean, I'm sure he has a Twitter account and I'm sure it's great, but, you know, his job is to be an actor and his Twitter is sort of a secondary thing. And Breaking Bad and AMC have a social media team that takes care of that. And then, of course, you get all this user-generated content. And because Breaking Bad is generally still airing at a certain time, like, there is a time where people are watching Breaking Bad, even in the sort of fractured media environment that we have, that's when they can really spike a lot of the interest. Whereas with an artist, unless they're doing something massive, you know, people are going to be tweeting about it and listening to the record and maybe watching the show at all different points of the day and night. And I mean, yeah, I'm sure Lady Gaga does have a social media manager, and I'm sure a lot of her tweets are actually the social media manager's tweets, but I just feel like it's a slightly different commitment that we're asking from actors and actresses and TV folks versus what we ask for from musicians.
You're absolutely right. Especially when you're talking about independent musicians who are, you know, like you said, just maybe starting out, it's a lot for them to do. There's just like a lot of noise on these networks. So, you know, it's debatable whether it's even worth it. There's a lot of acts who have big songs and become huge superstars don't do any of this stuff. You know, look at Drake. Does he tweet a lot? Not really. You know, Lil Wayne, does he tweet a lot? Not really. It's not like they're creating, you know, all this transmedia. I mean, they're basically doing what they do, and maybe they go on Twitter and they put up a little something, you know, hey, check this out. You know, maybe they put up a little, I know Drake in particular is good with like subliminal stuff. You know, you don't even know what the hell he's talking about. But, you know, there's something to be said for just staying away from all of that stuff. But I do think that some of these artists are propped up by the machine. And if you don't have the machine, your only option is to kind of create one yourself. I mean, if every door is closed, I mean, you just have to build a whole new house. So, you know, we have a lot of tools to sort of do that. I wouldn't really advise anybody who's a musician to not think of themselves these days as a startup and be approaching it that way. I mean, I would say this is how much you need to really do this. You know, you need X amount of dollars, and these are the commitments that you need to think of. There's a great book, you know, Donald Passman's like All You Need to Know About the Music Business. That whole book needs like a whole new chapter on, you know, on all of this stuff. Because in that book, it's like, you get a manager and then you get this. And it's like very old school. It doesn't really work that way now. And that's for a YouTube star. I mean, how useful is a book like that? You know, they're sort of putting themselves out there and there's all the, you know, they attain all these, you know, fans, and then they have to like kind of figure out how to convert those fans into something real. And they're having a lot of problems with it. You know, YouTube really hasn't come up with a business model that makes any sense for its creatives. The people who fill up the space, you know, aren't making any money. So there is still something to be said for that traditional record business and working in the sort of pop factory of let's just make one single and make it super popular. And look at, you know, Pitbull. I mean, Pitbull is so popular and he's not in the conversation at all. I mean, he's so big. I mean, the guy's huge. You know, he's a global superstar and you don't see anything from him. Nothing, you know, so he's completely reliant on making a great record and letting the radio blow it up.
Well, I mean, the thing with Pitbull though is he's also got brand deals with everyone and their mother. Like, so I feel like I just see Pitbull whenever I go to corporate events. I'm like, oh, look, Pitbull's playing the branded such and such party. Good for him. But I wanted to sort of switch tracks a little bit, and talk a little bit about the sort of, I guess, marriage between TV and music, if that's possible. And that's the idea of live streaming concerts. And I've been sort of positing a theory for a while that has yet to come to fruition, so I could be wrong. But I have this theory that at some point people will watch live stream concerts like they watch TV shows, meaning that I will come home from work and I will turn on my TV-like thing, whether that's an Apple TV or some sort of a smart TV or my laptop or whatever, and I'll have a channel that is the Bowery Presents channel, just for example, or the Live Nation channel, or any, you know, presenter's channel, and I'll say, okay, tonight I'm going to watch whatever's happening at Mercury Lounge, or, you know, I heard about a band today, they seem pretty good, they're playing in my town in 2 weeks. Hey, I'm just going to watch the show that they did in Cleveland last night, see if they're any good, see if I want to go. And, you know, make it something almost like, oh, you know, people are going to come over to my house and hang out. And rather than watching a baseball game, we'll watch a concert, maybe a music festival that's happening in Portugal. And we're here in New York watching this music festival. So do you sort of have a sense that that might be something that is going to come in the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, one, I think that's a brilliant, you know, idea, and I'm sure that somebody somewhere is probably working on something to that effect. I mean, you've obviously seen different brands come in and try to like sponsor and support one-off events like that. I know YouTube has, you know, streamed a variety of concerts. MTV has as well. It's all, you know, the live streamed concert. A couple of years ago, we all sat and watched, you know, the Tupac hologram at Coachella, you know. So it's like, it's been done, but it hasn't been done in a way that you're describing, which is that it would be happening kind of continuously, and it becomes a thing where you can always sort of turn it on. I think that Boiler Room TV did something like that last year, which I think was part of a Red Bull Music, you know, I think they had something to do with it. And it was kind of like that. You know, it was like live streaming from the such and such hotel or from the Mercury Lounge or what have you. I think one thing that's holding that back is the technology right now is not quite there. Sometimes
the rights issues are also, I'm sure, a complete nightmare.
Yeah, that also is a big, you know, basically, you know, if you want to live stream something, you almost have to clear everything. It becomes a little bit of a headache. I mean, rights clearance is a headache in and of itself for anything. Basically, whoever owns intellectual property is, you know, the one kind of running things. But there is opportunity to just do live streams, simple enough, with a Google Hangout. Google Hangout is really like a powerful platform that nobody's really utilizing, at least as far as I can see, in the way that it could be used, which is we did something last year when I was still working at AOL Music, which was basically a live interview. I mean, we just people at AOL said we don't have. I mean, just to give you a very practical example, there was two things happening at AOL. There was Huffington Post Live, which is a whole thing with $1 million operation, and there was AOL Music, which had like no money. And I said, how can we do a Huffington Post Live without any money? And I just thought about it and said, well, Google basically, the Hangout thing allows you to basically do a live stream without having to spend all the money on the stream. They're basically giving it to you. So it's just at the mercy of your front-end technology. Like, is your camera good enough? Is your lighting good? Is the stream good? So because they did that, we did it. And the Plus people reached out to me, and they loved the fact that we had done it like that. And they were like, wow, we haven't really seen anyone utilize this thing in this way. And I said, yeah, I want to keep doing this. I want to just make a whole chat show with Google Plus. I don't want to use Google Plus as a community thing where I have like 15 people in a room and we're all chatting. I just want to set up a camera and use the Google Plus program to live stream an event. And that, you know, they're kind of giving it to you. And it, like I said, not enough people are utilizing it in that way. But the audience is huge for Google Plus. I mean, it's just about people getting on it, you know, and really knowing that what you're doing is there. And also the cool thing about it is the stuff gets indexed. So let's say the three of us right now, let's say we had our own live show and we were, you know, broadcasting it on Google Plus. As soon as it's done, it's going to go up on, you know, on YouTube. So anybody can look at it anytime. You know, that's, you know, amazing technology that's there for free, basically.
Yeah, and I am also sort of curious about, you know, what this means for sort of the concert attendance or the future of concerts, and especially the future of rock concerts, where, you know, like an EDM show, I can't really see someone watching an EDM show on their computer. Like, that just seems like something you would have to experience. But I feel like for a more sedate indie rock show, I don't know. I mean, I don't know that I'd be perfectly happy to just sit and watch them play on the like nice gigantic flat screen TV in my living room, as opposed to like going to the Mercury Lounge, paying $10 to get in, you know, having some gigantic tall dude stand in front of me and get, you know, pay $7 for beer. And, you know, part of it, this sort of ties back to your point about in your article about film. When you're watching TV, for me, part of it is like I can control my experience. So I'm in my living room, which I have set up to be very comfortable. I have my gigantic TV, which is a great quality screen and it didn't cost that much money. If I need to get up and use the bathroom, I can pause whatever I'm watching. If I'm hungry, I can eat whatever I have in my kitchen rather than having to like buy food at a concession stand that is overpriced and disgusting. I can tweet about what I'm watching. I can pause what I'm watching and look something up on my iPad. Like, part of the reason that TV is great is because I can entirely control my experience, pretty much. And I feel like because people are now becoming used to that, I feel like maybe the film industry and the music industry are going to have to start adapting to that. Because if it's just as good to like watch a concert at home as it is to go get jostled around the Mercury Lounge, like then what happens? Then what happens to the concert business? Then what happens to movie theaters? You know, going to movie theaters sucks unless you're going to a handful of really good ones. Like going to the I don't go to the AMC because it blows. It's uncomfortable. It's expensive. You know, I can't control my experience. I can't pause and look something up or tweet about it. Like, so I'm just kind of wondering how that sort of overall picture is going to play out.
Well, I think one thing I spoke about in that piece was that the theater industry needs to figure out how to incentivize moviegoers. Are they going to make this thing into an experience, or is it going to be basically the same thing that we've been experiencing since 1930? In fact, it's actually worse than 1930, because even in 1930, you would go to like a movie palace and you like this huge thing that looked architecturally beautiful. Now you just kind of go to a multiplex and it's just this really mundane, boring mall-like experience. Depending on the movie you go to, you know, people are disruptive and sort of not polite. Now, you know, because vaporizing is such a big thing, you're in a theater, a lot of people are smoking vaporizers and stuff like that.
What?
So you got big billowy clouds sort of going up in the middle of the movie.
No, wait, people do that? I've never seen that. That is horrifying to me.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean,
I've been at like weird midnight shows where people are smoking pot. I've never seen, oh my God. Another reason for me not to go to the movies.
I was just at a show a couple of weeks ago. I guess it's called the Bowtie Cinema now. It's on 23rd and 8th in Chelsea in Manhattan. They do a midnight screening of Rocky Horror Picture Show. It's like Rocky Horror Picture Show is like the longest running movie in the history of like cinema. It's been playing continuously at this theater for like ever since it came out. So we happened to be watching a movie, and it was just all this commotion, you know, and just loudness coming from outside. And I go outside, and what is it? It's all these people there for the Rocky Horror Picture Show, you know. And it was – I had to talk to the owner. I said, can you guys like kind of – can you get this under control? Because this is really ruining the experience here. I mean, this is not a – it's like $14 for a ticket there, you know.
Yeah.
To have to, you know, which I love the fact that Rocky Horror Picture Show is playing. I mean, that in and of itself is awesome, you know. But the rowdiness and the fact that, you know, they're basically serving alcohol there and it becomes like a party, you know, it kind of takes away from the regular people who are just watching a film.
Right. See, that I would argue, like, the Rocky Horror Picture Show, I feel like, would be something that endures because it's fun, it's interactive, it's goofy. It's more the sort of idea of like I saw Bridesmaids at the AMC in Midtown somewhere, and it was like, again, it was so such a crappy experience. It was like, you know, I'm gonna pay $7 for soda, maybe a little bit of candy, which I don't even really want. I'm gonna sit in an uncomfortable chair. I can't talk to anyone, I can't tweet about how funny it is. Like, I mean, I almost feel like the Rocky Horror thing is like gonna endure because that's just a completely different experience. But this idea of like getting shuttled in to sort of a crappy room, sitting in a chair silently for 3 hours and getting shuttled out, like that just seems like a terrible way to consume any piece of content. And it's kind of the same way with concerts. Like a lot of the big rock shows, you're kind of like shuttled in, you know, maybe you dance, maybe you cheer, maybe you sing along, but like, you know, it's a more fun experience than the movies, but you still don't have a ton of control over your overall experience.
That to me, what, you know, what you're speaking of, and to the point of what I was describing about Rocky Horror Picture Show, that's the enduring allure of the Rocky Horror Picture Show at that theater. I mean, that's really why people go there every night. It's like that. That midnight screening is just such a like an event to go to. I mean, people are dressed up. That's in a way, you know, it becomes like something to do. Now imagine if, you know, every movie was like that. Now maybe that's the future of the movie business. I don't know, because when you see something like the Rocky Horror Picture Show and it's there for so long, and the reason why it's there for so long is because this theater in particular has made it into this event. And it's sort of communal because everybody that's there knows they're there to see it. So it kind of becomes like a party, you know? Is that the future of the movie business? It might be. It's the same at concerts. Price on concerts is really out of control right now. You know, ticket prices have gone up so much because everybody wants to make so much money on these things. And the end consumer is the one who is kind of getting the short end of the stick. Imagine how easy it would be to sell out a concert if the ticket was like $5, you know. But when a ticket's like, for even a marginally talented artist or popular artist, a ticket's like $120 or something. I mean, how many times a year can you really do that? I mean, if you're just a normal person, the average American really doesn't have a ton of money lying around just to go to concerts. You know, it's sort of a, what am I going to pay for? Am I going to pay for groceries this month, or am I going to go pay to see, you know, I don't know, anyone. I mean, outside of somebody like Beyonce or that like 1%, you know, of artists, that top tier, boy, who is going to go see somebody, you know, if they have to spend that much money? They would much rather just stay at home. They didn't want to deal with that, you know, that sort of awful experience of being at the concert. One thing though that concerts do offer is they offer human connection. You know, nothing will ever replace the idea of thinking I might go out and maybe I can meet somebody that I like, you know, at a concert, and, you know, maybe we hit it off, maybe we fall in love, something like that. I mean, that's what concerts have going for them in a lot of ways. It's a shared experience. You share it with other people, and there has to be a better way to kind of induce that activity, though, and that part of it, I don't think the concert industry has quite figured out. A lot of venues just aren't built for that sort of thing right now.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your thoughts. If people want to find you online, where can they look you up?
Well, they can just probably follow my Twitter account, which is, you know, /PaulKanner. Yeah, I write a lot on Medium, so, you know, my Medium is at Paul Kanner as well. That's pretty much it.
All right, sounds good. Well, that's all for this episode of The Upward Spiral. Thanks to Hypebot.com for helping me put this podcast out. If you have any questions or comments, email us at upwardspiralpodcast@gmail.com, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at upwardspiralpod. And don't forget to subscribe on iTunes. If you like the show, please rate us highly and submit a review. Thank you for listening.